Welcome to The Health Edge, translating the science of self-care. So glad to be with you. I am Mark Pettis. I am a nephrologist, integrative health doc, also an internist, did primary care some time back, along with nephrology. And currently I oversee medical education and population health at Berkshire Health Systems in Western Massachusetts. And I also serve as the Associate Dean of Medical Education at University of Massachusetts Medical School. And so just a little bit of my pedigree for new users, and coming to you from Western Massachusetts in the beautiful Berkshires. And I'm on with my good friend and colleague, Dr. John Bagnulo, who's in a very different part of the world. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mark. I'm a professional coconut harvester these days, so... It is great, though, to be here in Costa Rica with the family for this extended stay. It's unexpected. You know, we had twins here. Joanna had twins, which was a surprise. And then we, you know, had them 4 weeks early. So we're here waiting for their U.S. citizenship to get approved. And as they say here in Costa Rica, pura vida, which means we're living the good life. Mm. And all is well.
That's beautiful, John. We need to a television crew following you. This would be interesting reality TV.
Yes, it would be.
I know you're in such a beautiful environment. I often think of Costa Rica, particularly the Nicoya Peninsula, as one of the blue zones, one of these places on the planet, yeah, right, that has extraordinarily long life expectancy and good quality of life. And I know, John, in your future New World Order, as you get back to the States at some point over the spring, you know, you mentioned you might be doing a bit more consultation and reinvigorating a small part of your prior practice. Is that
I think that's probably, you know, in my short term goals is to get that clinical practice back up and running.
Yeah,
definitely.
And I know a lot of our listeners may have some interest in connecting with you at some point professionally. Yeah. And so when the time is right over the next, you know, 2-3 months, we'll get information to them as that unfolds.
Yeah, thank you, Mark.
So I was commenting, John, and how in our last podcast we were talking about the importance of mitochondria, not just in the energy they produce, but... as very vulnerable organelles in terms of oxidative stress and inflammation and insulin resistance, and just how commonly now mitochondrial dysfunction is associated with all chronic complex diseases. Mm. And we thought we might reflect a little more specifically today on brain-related issues where the mitochondria are central, brain being a very power-centric organ, consuming a great deal of percentage of body energy produced, and commonly associated with Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and ALS and multiple sclerosis and autism and autism spectrum. So many things that are good for the mitochondria are also good for brain health. And we've had other podcasts, John, where we've talked about inflammation and the importance of immune system balance. So it seemed to me, John, as we think about brain health, that some of these core metabolic fault lines, insulin resistance, inflammation, mitochondrial disruption, are important areas to continue to keep people connected to, because ultimately those are the metabolic fault lines that drive our risk of those diseases, how quickly those diseases progress. And the context that we want to create in this podcast is that there are a lot of things we can do by way of lifestyle to improve mitochondrial function, reduce inflammation, enhance insulin sensitivity, and in doing so can considerably set themselves up for not only longer lives, but sharper minds, better mood, more emotional and cognitive resilience. And that's a very different context, John, right, than accepting the cards you've been dealt and yeah. hoping that cards that maybe didn't do too well in your extended family won't rear their ugly heads in your life.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, Mark, what the picture that you just painted is, hopefully it's clear that everything is amplified when it comes to the brain. So any imbalance that you may not see in another area of your physiology is quickly apparent with respect to brain health, because it does require such a massive percentage of the body's energy producing efforts. You know, anywhere from 25 to 30% of the body's energy is usually going to be devoted to brain activity, whether we're asleep or, you know, we're about, you know, inactive during the day. And so because everything is amplified with respect to how our lifestyle influences the brain, it is, you know, really physiologically, it's at the confluence of so many components of lifestyle, you know, circulation, right? And how well the body's able to distribute blood flow, inflammation, insulin resistance, like you just mentioned. And, you know, one thing that a lot of people aren't aware of, Mark, is that you can have a certain amount of insulin resistance of the brain where the brain cells are unable to utilize glucose as they should be because they've become over-dependent upon it. And you may not have any warning signs with respect to insulin resistance of the rest of the body. The two can be independent processes, meaning that a person's fasting glucose levels can look okay, and yet the brain is not getting the glucose that it needs, and it goes into a energy crisis, and then you start to see all of those different disease processes that people are desperately trying to avoid. So it's just, you know, everything is intensified when it comes to brain health. If you have any type of imbalance, you know, within the diet or other areas of lifestyle, you know, if you don't have enough exercise and blood isn't flowing through the body as fluidly as it should be, then, you know, you're going to have issues with brain health.
And we know, John, that movement is a really powerful way to lower inflammation or inflammatory burden, improving mitochondrial function, not just the function of the mitochondria, yeah, but the generation of new mitochondria, mitochondrial biogenesis, making new mitochondria. We know that that movement is the holy grail for insulin resistance. So when we begin to tie back some of these lifestyle interventions, if you will, with their impact on those metabolic fault lines, you can begin to appreciate the synergy of lifestyle, right? It's as you often say, John, one plus one equals five. One plus one equals 15. So these become much more powerful in aggregate. So we also know, John, that the prevalence, if you look at any one point in time, the number of people dealing with either a cognitive decline, pre-Alzheimer's, if you will, or Alzheimer's, people that are dealing with, say, depression or anxiety, people dealing with a loved one on the autism spectrum, people confronting Parkinson's disease, that these are going up in prevalence. These are going up dramatically in prevalence. So with every passing year, there are more people on the planet that have those diagnoses. So I think it's also important to realize that our current models of care, which continue to look for the magic bullet for Alzheimer's, a bullet they've been looking for the last 30 years, and there's really been very little in the advancement of pharmaco intervention for Alzheimer's disease. And I'm not suggesting they shouldn't continue to look for meaningful pathways there, but the answer will not be forthcoming by way of a magic bullet, nor was the answer forthcoming for any of these other diseases that we're talking about for a magic bullet. Many of the medicines that come out can certainly help with symptom management and can certainly help keep things in check, but rarely do they get to the root causes of the disease, and rarely do they influence the natural progression of those diseases. So I'm stating the obvious, I know, John, but the current state is one that does not leave much opportunity to really shift the curve in terms of prevalence, in terms of disease management, and even the radical consideration that something like Alzheimer's might actually be treatable, and for some, perhaps more on the earlier end of the spectrum, even reversible, is an entirely different paradigm. This is like saying the world is not flat. It's like saying that the Earth is not at the center of the solar system. And so these are radically different paradigms that I think, you know, you and I are both suggesting should become the paradigm of the present and future, but one that still does not exist in our developed countries, right?
Yeah. I mean, to think that Alzheimer's is solely a function of a person's genetics is really ridiculous, given all of the different inputs we've seen now to the pathology, right? I mean, if I were to pick three things for people, our listeners, to really focus on that I feel have the greatest control over Alzheimer's, one of those would be really to try to get your body to manufacture large, buoyant LDLs, right? Most of the overlap here in research between lipoprotein synthesis in the body, meaning the types of lipoproteins that you manufacture in the liver, whether they're, you know, HDLs, LDLs, your VLDLs, it's really apparent now. We want very large, buoyant LDLs because not only is that protective against heart disease, but that's huge when it comes to brain health, right? In preventing Alzheimer's and all of the different moieties of that disease. And then, as you mentioned, you know, you say this a lot, Mark, motion is the lotion. And people who exercise regularly, more so than probably any other lifestyle characteristic, people who move daily, and that doesn't have to be prescribed exercise, but people who walk daily, who are active and aren't sitting around or just chained to a desk, those people have a markedly reduced risk for Alzheimer's. So those are two big ones. And then, of course, it's always about inflammation, right? What can you do to reduce inflammation in your daily life? And certainly there's a lot of things you can do with respect to your outlook on the world around you and, you know, striving to have more gratitude and less hostility. And then there's, you know, a long list of foods, right, that are anti-inflammatory and is the usual suspects that generate more inflammation. If I were to pick three processes that have the greatest control or different things that we have at our disposal to try to change our odds, it would be those. It would be movement, inflammation, and producing large, buoyant LDLs.
Yeah, beautiful, John. And when I think about movement, as we reflected on in our, I believe it was our last podcast, if you're moving outside and you allow yourself more full spectrum light exposure, in particular from the standpoint of A, boosting your vitamin D, which we know is an important signaling molecule. This is a nuclear transcription factor that will turn on a whole cascade of resiliency genes, right? Lowering inflammation, improving mitochondrial function, helping with insulin sensitivity. So it hits the trinity of those metabolic issues. And as we always talk about, John, you there probably are advantages of getting this via sunlight. Sensible sunlight exposure becomes critical. And then we talk about that far red end of the light continuum, John, as we touched on in the last podcast, and how uniquely those wavelengths of light are uniquely marvelous for mitochondrial function. They'll improve oxidation. They will reduce oxidative stress. They release nitric oxide, which helps with what you touched on, the circulation, the oxygen delivery. So if one is more thoughtful of the environment within which they are moving, they can really accelerate the therapeutic effect of that precious moment of time that they're investing in their self-care. And when I think about inflammation, John, and again, I think all of these metabolic issues are so linked. What's good for inflammation is good for mitochondrial health, is good for insulin sensitivity. One of the things that I'm struck by, John, in looking at some of the research, is there was a study. I'll post a few of these studies, John, but there was a study in 2012 in neurology. There were some follow-up, very similar studies in the Annals of Internal Medicine, and I want to say 2014, and the New England Journal of Medicine, which may have been 2014, 2015. And this exquisite sensitivity, John, between higher sugar levels, higher fasting glucoses, glucoses that many people, A, aren't even aware of, perhaps, have never had them measured, or glucoses that perhaps they have been told are okay. Interesting about these studies, John, is that there is a linear relationship between how high one's fasting sugar is and how their cognitive function will be in 2 years, 3 years, 5 to 7 years. And even with fasting sugars that we would consider normal or you know, insignificant, risk continues to be present. You know, fasting sugars in the high 90s to 100. Generally, we say between 100 and 125 is prediabetes, over 125 is diabetes. But we know that even if you get, say, 90 to 100, that there still appears to be positive correlation with cognitive decline over time. So the brain is exquisitely sensitive when it comes to insulin resistance. And so I'm always focusing in my, at least nutritional approach to folks, John, of helping them lower their insulin and sugar levels. I know you talk about this all the time, the HOMA score, a fasting glucose, a fasting insulin. It is a powerful biomarker that insurance will cover, is free. It's just getting your doctor to see the value of it and being willing to order it. And we know that assertive restriction of these carbohydrate dense foods, right? It's the same themes keep coming back. Can very effectively lower insulin resistance, lower insulin levels, and in doing so, lower inflammation. So carbohydrate dense foods are really problematic. And so from an insulin perspective, to me, that is the greatest opportunity for modification of macronutrient.
Yeah.
And then we talk a lot about getting healthier fat sources because they're insulin neutral and they will stimulate, you know, actual oxidation of fatty acids, one can start to have more effective fat as a fuel. You know, if somebody said, Mark, what is one of the single greatest contributors to whether a person lives long and well or not, I would have to say, John, I've come to this place where if glucose is the predominant fuel in your lifetime, you can expect a much shorter life expectancy and a much greater burden of chronic complex disease than if you are burning less sugar over the course of your lifetime and more fat. And so I think, you know, so much of what we're talking about is trying to change the fuel, the macronutrient, the quality of that macronutrient as your fuel source. And that we know in relatively short periods of time, days to even weeks, you can begin to totally reverse the insulin resistant metabolic issues that are in a very short time are going to start to put your brain in a much, much better place. So I think, you know, we sound like broken records, but it's particularly true when we look at the sensitivity of insulin and sugar to brain health, neuroplasticity, and you know, cognitive and emotional resilience.
You know, absolutely. That's the greatest return on investment that anybody can make. If they're just starting to grapple with the issue of brain health, and they, you know, may also be, you know, wrestling with other issues, whether it be weight or, you know, just how good they feel on a day-to-day basis. I mean, there is no better first step than to eliminate a major percentages of the carbohydrates in a person's diet and replace those with healthy fats. That's it, Mark. And then in addition to redistributing, you know, where we get our energy from and trying to become more fat-centric, you know, I think we've said on prior podcasts, Mark, that I like to see people, I feel, you know, I think you feel the same way, that people should get at least half of their energy from fat, and the majority of that should come from saturated and monounsaturated fat sources. And in addition to making these changes in the macronutrient distribution of our foods, being more fat-centric and being more vigilant around our refined carbohydrates, especially whether that comes from fruit or, you know, that comes from you know, some type of grain product. In addition to that, I think people need to be more cognizant of potential micronutrient deficiencies, which are very, very common. If you look at NHANES data, if you look at various investigations that have taken place at universities and other research extension centers, is that many people are deficient in vitamin B12 Many people are deficient in magnesium and other really, really important, critical brain modulating nutrients. So I always say to people, you know, make sure you've got a rich source of vitamin B12, make sure that you can actually absorb it. Make sure you have the minerals and trace minerals in place that support neurological health. I think that there is, you know, it's a tale of two cities, right? We're an overfed but malnourished country in the United States. In many ways, people get, you know, lots of calories and they get a lot of sugar and a lot of macronutrients per se, but the micronutrients are slowly but surely becoming more diluted, I would say, in the average American's diet.
Very important and very underappreciated in my experience, John. And often I will measure for these micronutrients, given what can sometimes be caveats in those measurements as reflecting total body burden, not uncommonly I will supplement if somebody's on the low end of a normal range or has a diet that, you know, with a dietary journal seems to be missing some of those key micronutrients. We know as well, John, that things like the omega-3s, you know, DHA and EPA are particularly important in brain health. Also, retinal health. I bring up the retina because it really is part of the central nervous system and has its own unique sort of metabolic landscape. And many people do lose their vision prematurely because they may be deficient in some of these key micronutrients, and in the instance of EPA and DHA, these essential omega-3 polyunsaturated fats.
Yeah, Mark, and just to touch on that quickly, we know from observational studies looking at larger populations, the people who eat oily fish twice, three times a week have a markedly reduced risk for Alzheimer's. You know, that those studies have been done in the UK, they've been done in various areas around the Mediterranean, even here in the US. You know, fish consumption is an interesting practice or lifestyle component that influences so much of our health. So, the greatest plausible explanation for that is that people who eat oily fish two or three times a week are getting more of that DHA and EPA that you're talking about.
No question, John. And there are so many other aspects of the diet, again, that we often reflect on. If you look at fermentable fiber, and again, the extent to which the human microbiome now has many central connections to brain health, either through neurotransmitter production. We know that tryptophan, a major precursor for serotonin, melatonin, is largely influenced at the level of the gut, dopamine, many other central neurotransmitters, inflammatory pathways are influenced by the gut, John, right? And so, again, we remind listeners of the importance of this ecosystem and designing a diet and lifestyle in a way that can optimize the diversity of that ecosystem as part of a brain health strategy. You've talked many times, John, and these are all deep, deep subjects in and of themselves, of how pesticide residues and antibiotic residues and glyphosate and genetically modified foods, we know, have significant impact as antibiotics on the diversity of the microbiome. And we know that things like glyphosate will interfere with the shikimate pathway in gut organisms that make it impossible for them to generate these aromatic amino acids, which are central building blocks to neurotransmitter function. So again, connecting diet with microbiome, with byproducts of that relationship, the short chain fatty acids, butyrate, and others that all of these dynamics significantly affect brain metabolic functional health. So I think the research there, John, has become really fascinating. Again, I think is a kind of an untapped horizon as far as things like Alzheimer's and ALS and Parkinson's and even autism spectrum.
Yeah. And I really like the link you make between eye health and brain health. I don't know how many of our listeners are aware of this, but when you start to have problems within the eye, let's say macular degeneration, for many reasons, you could call macular degeneration a neurodegenerative disease. And, you know, many people are not aware of that. And when you start to take, when you really look, Mark, at those dietary factors, or let's say lifestyle factors that put an individual at greater risk for macular degeneration, they're the exact same factors that put a person's brain at risk for premature aging and all of the different, you know, pathologies that we know we're trying to help people avoid. So what is that's good for the eye is most often really important for the brain as well. And, you know, there's really good evidence in addition to EPA and DHA that we spoke of. And again, I would want to mention that there's not as much evidence for taking fish oil as there is for eating small oily fish. You know, I think that's just an important differentiating point. We're not suggesting people go out and start hitting the fish oil as much as we are try to find a way to incorporate the most valuable fish for total health, which are small oily varieties. But in addition to the EPA and DHA, you know, there's really, really good evidence that zinc is highly protective against diseases of the eye. And you know, many people are zinc deficient, right, Mark? I mean, for one reason or another, either they're taking medications that inhibit zinc absorption, they've got a diet that's very low in zinc or is full of inhibitors. So, you know, that's another important nutrient that, you know, I think people need to understand is linked to brain health and, of course, eye health. And then the other thing that's fascinating, and this kind of goes back to our talk around the way we eat and having a little bit of intermittent fasting. Okay, so, you know, in addition, Mark, to the importance of certain micronutrients, whether that be EPA, DHA, the zinc, of course, we've talked about B12, which has been shown B12 deficiencies can you know, really drive amyloid tangles. In addition to those micronutrients, there's critical importance to the timing of when we eat and allowing the body to have these, you know, these prolonged fasts, whether it's 16 hours or 18 hours, or someone wants to fast for 24 hours, you know, that can be done, you know, I think in a healthy fashion. But when we start to eat after a fast, what's fascinating is that there's some evidence that stem cell differentiation, stem cell generation starts to take place in these just small enough waves that may be critical for brain health and to slow the aging process of the brain. But you know, you don't really get that stem cell activity other than you if you have that window of fasting prior to eating. So it's really, really cool stuff how, again, the confluence of all these different things can produce a very different outcome for a person's brain health.
And the brain, a bit unique in its love for ketones and yeah. Beta hydroxybutyrate is a ketone body, and that whole dimension, John, of intermittent fasting, of time restricted feeding, of as one way to develop ketones, a very low carb, generally, you know, 5% or less of your total macronutrient, much higher fat, ketogenic diets, certainly, well. I think not subjected to many clinical trials as yet. There are many observational studies and certainly anecdotes, case reports of people doing quite well on ketogenic diets or taking occasional, you know, medium chain triglycerides, you know, part of coconut oil as a precursor to beta hydroxybutyrate, and as a fuel, it can bypass these insulin glucose pathways that may not be operating efficiently. It's a very clean fuel. We know that it can influence epigenetic expression. So this is probably a powerful thing to be thinking about in terms of preserving brain and perhaps slowing progression in somebody that does have an established issue with cognition.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that people need to understand that the transition we're talking about, becoming a predominantly fat-centric metabolism, may require people, you know, over a course of a few days to a couple of weeks to make that adjustment. So initially, you know, I always say to people, if you're exercising intensively and you're trying to make the changes that you and I are talking about, Mark, here, where most of your meals have a very rich source of fat and you have very little carbohydrate in your diet, you could feel kind of lousy if the exercise in your life is still very intense. You know, you're going to need a couple of weeks when your body's adapting to reduce the intensity of your exercise. It's not to say you know, people should sit around, but they, when they're going for a walk or they're going for a run or they're spending time on a, whether it's a treadmill or a stationary bike, you may have to reduce the intensity of that exercise bout to a much lower intensity than you're used to, because you are training your body now. This isn't just about the brain, of course, right? This is the total, you know, systemic metabolism. People need to understand that making this transition, it might be uncomfortable for just a very short period of time. You just have to reduce the intensity of the exercise over the first week or two when you do that. And then on the topic of fasting, you know, for many people, if they hear us talk, Mark, about not eating for 16 or 18 hours, well, we know that's a very reasonable period of time to fast. For many people, they, you know, they may question whether or not it's doable in their life. And what I would say, and there's good evidence to support this, hey, just at least don't eat for 12 hours, right? If you eat dinner at 7 p.m., at least, you know, at the very least, don't eat until 7 a.m. the next day. That 12-hour fast carries, you know, a lot of very beneficial responses in the body. That, you know, that glucose insulin mediated pathway that is also critical for the brain getting the nutrients it needs. The brain becomes much less insulin resistant if we can give ourselves at least a 12-hour overnight fast, which for many people doesn't happen, right? Because they have dinner and then they have a snack maybe at 9 or 10 at night, and then breakfast is at 6. So, you know, that even that 12-hour overnight fast, you know, I think that carries a lot of value.
Definitely. And we know that it upregulates so many resiliency pathways, John, from BDNF, this brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is kind of a miracle grow for the brain. You know, that we know that nutrient-dense foods can do that. We know that intermittent fasting can do that. We know that movement can do that. This is one metabolic pathway that gets turned on with those interventions. We know that NRF2, sort of an anti-oxidative stress, detoxifying metabolic pathway, is also very much turned on by many of these same things, John. We know that NF-kappa B, the major sort of pro-inflammatory metabolic pathway, is inhibited and sort of brought down with many of these. So you start to see these key metabolic pathways influenced in a very favorable way with respect to all of these metabolic fault lines, whether it's mitochondrial dysfunction or insulin resistance or inflammatory overdrive, John. And maybe a good area of research to summarize so much of what we've been talking about is the work of Dale Bredesen at the Buck Institute in California. Yeah. And I know many of our listeners are familiar with his work. He, in a very small study, looked at people with really more advanced Alzheimer's and attempted to look at a multidimensional program that addressed insulin resistance and inflammation and addressed the key micronutrients that you talked about, John, magnesium, zinc, developed a very omega-3 rich diet in the form of fatty fish and low glycemic, low refined carbohydrate. Lots of greens and right, the plant-based foods that we know from the MIND study and many Mediterranean diet studies have shown brain health benefit. So he really looked at insulin and looked at many biomarkers, from insulin levels to C-reactive protein, vitamin D. And what he found as he identified opportunities at many levels in all of these 10 subjects, as he began to improve these metabolic landscapes, he saw dramatic improvements in their cognition, and much of which I think had never been reported, and still perhaps a mindset would suggest, John, that we just don't think of that as possible. So we know that even from his preliminary work, and I know there are other trials out that are ongoing, that even somebody with more advanced features, someone not able to work, someone requiring a great deal of caregiving, might respond dramatically to lifestyle interventions that explicitly and in concert address these many metabolic features. And I will link Bredesen's work, but I think that it summarizes a lot of what we've been talking about, John.
Yeah, absolutely. I think his work is at the epicenter of this this subject. And there, you know, what Bredesen's shown, and then what a handful of other studies have shown in very similar but much more myopic approaches, the use of particular botanicals that can modulate NFKB levels, for instance, whether it be ginkgo. There are studies going back now 25 or 30 years showing improvements with patients who have Alzheimer's with the use of the right ginkgo supplement. I think the right supplement are the operative words there, because there are so many ginkgo supplements that are of really poor quality. But things like turmeric or curcumin that can be absorbed, ginkgo, there's a short list of those botanicals that have great influence on NFKB levels. And I think we could couple those, Mark, if you can couple some of those types of interventions with the overall diet we're talking about and giving yourself a little bit of a window of fasting. I think that the potential there, and I hope most of our listeners can understand that, the potential there is dramatic.
And something you've touched on, John, many times is that on the surface, this might seem like a really challenging and difficult thing to do. Yet, in my experience, if people have the right partnerships, you know, working with a dietitian who can help them with some of this, you know, maybe a provider that can understand many of these, types of interventions, that it's not too hard to at least begin to implement a lot of what we've been talking about in ways that, I think could help a lot of people and might lead to surprisingly large impact, much more so than one might predict.
Absolutely. So in summary, Mark, maybe we could share people what a typical day could look like. Maybe, you know, we could share that with our listeners, you know, the foods, the timing of meals, the amount of exercise it might take to start to shift maybe the things more in favor of brain balance.
Yeah, absolutely, John. Well, so go ahead. I mean, you do a lot of this every day in your own life, and I know see it as pretty much routine. So take us through. What would that look like?
Yeah, well, I think the starting point would be, again, depending on when someone eats dinner, but if dinner was at, 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock, at the very least, I think people need to give themselves a 12-hour, if it's longer, that's great, but at least a 12-hour window of fasting where they're not eating again until the following morning. Now, I can tell you right now that the way I grew up as a kid, that never happened. I mean, we would eat dinner and then my father and I would split a half gallon of ice cream at 9 o'clock at night when we were watching a movie. So it's just, I know that this is not the norm in most households, but I think it has huge value to not eat from dinner until the following breakfast. And you know, again, some of those populations that have very low levels of cognitive decline that we see here in the United States, that's the norm, right? They eat dinner and then they don't eat, at night while they're, on the couch watching a movie. They may go to bed early, they may go outside and go for a walk, but they don't eat all night. So that would be my number one starting point. The number two thing, Mark, would be make sure, and I wouldn't say that this would be one and two in terms of priority, but make sure that the diet becomes much more fat-based, especially with saturated fat sources such as coconut oil, you mentioned, is very valuable. Butter, olive oil is always a good staple. And then just naturally fat-rich foods like avocados and eggs, those are great foundation foods, almonds, macadamia nuts, that people should have on hand so that if they do feel they're in a tough spot and they need to eat something, they, just don't feel well-centered because of their hunger or whatever, they can turn to those instead of getting the quick fix from carbs. So that leads me to a meal pattern, Mark, which would be eggs and green leafy vegetables. Then you're getting the lutein, which has been shown to be very protective against problems within the eye. You're getting magnesium in large levels. The eggs are a great source of choline and other phospholipids that we know are important for neurological health that a lot of people are not getting. So, I think eggs cooked in coconut oil with greens or olive oil, are a great starting point to the day. And then at least a couple times a week, try to have sardines, mackerel, smaller varieties of tuna like skipjack tuna, grass-fed meat, all of these foods coupled with non-starchy vegetables and high-quality fats and oils, whether it's guacamole or it's making a dressing for a salad out of olive oil and lemon juice. But, just really try to keep protein at around 20 to 25% of calories and fat at least at 50% of calories. And the carbohydrates that make up the remainder should come from, if possible, select fruits like berries as opposed to bananas, you know, and you know, I think that's like the general blueprint that I'd go with, Mark.
Fantastic, John. And we talk about being outside as much as one can, being mindful of the quality of lighting in indoor settings, you know, in general, incandescent, halogen lighting gives you a bit more of representation of that full light spectrum. We've talked about ways that one can adjust the color temperature of laptops and smartphones, and there are many apps that can help filter out some of that high energy blue light toward the end of the day. Very important that your retina is not getting a big blue light blast beyond the time of day where you should be expecting it. We also know that that light can interfere with sleep, a major determinant of inflammation and mitochondrial function. And I think so the lighting, I think, John, it becomes another part of that routine and being mindful of those rhythms. I think sleep hygiene, and again, I think some of this stuff is just blocking and tackling, but just trying to be consistent with bedtime and keeping the room very dark. Any light at all will disrupt your melatonin signaling, even though the room may seem dark. So there's dark, and then there is pitch black. Cooler environments at night can be helpful. A little centering relaxation exercise, maybe a little gratitude journal. Maybe for some it may take the form of prayer. For others, you know, just some basic meditation, a little guided imagery. I'll often just, you know, reflect on something that went really well, or something that made me really happy, or a moment during the day where, you know, love was just, you know, a dominant force in that moment. And so all these things, while they may not, they don't really take a lot of time, and we know that they have really dramatic biologic outputs that are very much aligned with all that we've been talking about, John. And so, to bring that in with all this other, you know, time restricted feeding and considering macronutrient balance and quality, and then I think some of the micronutrient issues that you reflected on, John, some of which just require testing and finding a practitioner who understands the value of testing, and then maybe most importantly, John, and I see you've got your partner with you. Sir Mac, you know, love and connection is, right. There is no substitute. I think we touched on, at least a good context, John, and I hope this was helpful for folks. Any parting thoughts?
No, I just would reiterate what you said. I think, outlook on life, it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we're hostile and, you know, we're looking at the world through a dark lens, it gets just darker. And I think, you know, it's a two-way street, right? I mean, you gotta live a different lifestyle to have a different outlook, but you also have to try, you know, you have to be cognizant of your outlook. And if you see that you're, you know, hostile, or you're, you know, tending to look at things more in a negative lens, it's just gonna, you know, it's gonna make things snowball. So I really like what you said about gratitude. You know, whether it's at the end of the day or it's in the morning with your cup of coffee, you know, try to find that time, that window of time every day when you give thanks for all that is. You know, life's a very difficult journey, whether or not you have great brain health or not, but you got to do what you can to give thanks for the fact that you are awake to meet yet another day. So Mark.
And our brains seem exquisitely sensitive, but both as a contributor to that mindset and also as a recipient of that mindset. This is
for sure
our relationship. We are self-organizing beings, and I think self and co-creating beings, and I think our potential to create our reality is much greater than maybe what we've given ourselves credit for, John. So
right on.
Lot of fun, great topic. We appreciate people listening to The Health Edge. And John, I'm very appreciative of you being up at extraordinary off hours down there in Costa Rica.
I love this, Mark.
And connecting with
this.
Us and sharing with the world. And folks can check us out on iTunes and give us a thumbs up if this content creates some value for you. We'll put some links, and we do have several papers on our website, thehealthedgepodcast.com, that we referenced the full PDF manuscripts for people that want to take a bit of a deeper dive in Dale Bredesen's work or some of the neurologic studies that we talked about. So thank you for listening, and John, thanks so much as always for connecting with us.
Thank you, Mark. Great to see you.
Peace.